This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you for being here. It's a very, very great pleasure. So I will start in Russian with a few verses of a poem. У мачехи ласковой в желтой я вырос стране, и желтые кроткие люди мне братьями стали. Здесь неповторимые сказки мерещились мне, и летние звезды в ночи для меня расцветали. If I translate, I grew up with my stepmother, tender and yellow, and the gentle yellow people became my brothers. Here, unforgettable tales filled my dreams, and summer stars blossomed for me. So these lines are taken from a poem entitled Nostalgia. They may express the feelings of many foreigners who lived in Manchuria, China, China's northeast, during the first half of the 20th century, and who indeed could not or cannot forget that part of their life. They were written, the verses that I just read, by Valery Perelishin, a Russian emigre poet whose biography had much in common with those who ended up by living in Russia abroad. It also had its specific features. After having escaped the civil war in Russia, like other tens of thousands of refugees, Perelishin grew up in Harbin, studied law and theology in that city, became a monk, joined the Peking Russian ecclesiastical mission in China, was deported back to China after attempting to emigrate to the US in the early 50s because of suspected communist sympathies. He had worked for some time as a Russian translator for the Shanghai office of TASS, and finally emigrated to Brazil. Perelishin started to write his poetry in the acneist vein while still in China. In Brazil, he continued to write in Russian, but also in Portuguese, and translated Chinese, Portuguese, and Brazilian poetry into Russian. At the end of his life, he was considered one of the masters of the Russian sonnet, into which he gave his full canonization. A reactionary in his opinions on the formal side of poetic language, Perelishin was also very modern in some of its themes. If you Google Perelishin today, he appears first in queerbio.com and other sites presenting the gay and homoerotic aspect of his poetry. So not all memories of those who grew up among the gentle yellow people are tales of blossoming summer tales. Here are a few lines from a Japanese song entitled The Crying of a Shrike in a Withered Tree. I quote from a book written by Shinichi Yamamuro, Manchuria under Japanese Dominion, translated by Joshua Fogel. Old brothers gone off to Manchuria, gunfire glistening in his tears. The shrike is cold and crying out. Older brother is even colder. You will hear that song in the film that will be screened later today. The melody, with lyrics by Sato Hachiro and music composed by Tokomi Shigeru, was hummed as if muttered in Japan during the 1930s. And numerous Japanese emigres flocked to Manchuria to help build the great empire of Manchukuo. The Manchurian writer, writes Yamamuro, is said to reach as low, the Manchurian winter, is said to reach as low as 40 degrees below zero. In this intensely cold terrain of the north, state building ideals rapidly froze. In her book Memory Maps, The State and Manchuria in Postwar Japan, anthropologist Mariko Tamanoi refers to the narratives of those Japanese who remember Manchuria and to the, quote, complex interactions between the present and the past that these narratives reveal. The term memory map is used by Tamanoi to problematize the concept of memory, which is always embedded in a time, a society, a place, and a culture, which is always mediated by the interviewer, listener, or reader, which is influenced by other memories. So my object here are three of such maps. The first are the memories of Russians, Poles, Jews, and other ethnic minorities who inhabited Manchuria and the city of Harbin in particular during the first half of the 20th century. The second are the memories of Japanese urban inhabitants and rural settlers who migrated to Manchuria during the era of the quote-unquote puppet state of Manchukuo between 32 and 45. The third are the reminiscences of the local residents, most of them Han Chinese, for whom Manchuria is, at least officially, Wei Manzhougou, or Wei Man, fake Manchuria, until the present day. Many other ethnicities lived in China's northeast at that time, more than 30 in Harbin alone, starting with the Manchus, whose complex history from their failure to maintain sovereignty over their homeland to further failures of re-territorialization, including the impossibility of establishing a Manzhu ethnic autonomous region in today's China. All this has been described very well recently by Shao Dan in her book, Remote Homeland, Recovered Borderland, Manchus, Manchukuo, and Manchuria, 1907-1985. Other ethnicities include the Koreans, the Mongols, the Turk Tatars, and what was left of the nomadic small peoples of the Russian borderland, of the Chinese-Russian borderland. But to account for them, as important as the R for the full picture, extends the range of this presentation and the context in which it is written. So the present work, the context, is part of an ongoing research in connection to a documentary film, the purpose of which is to portray what Manchuria or Harbin nostalgia was and is all about. The choice of film is motivated by the possibilities that this medium offers to convey feelings not always expressed by words, and by the wealth of visual documents available but seldom used as primary source, and I'd like to insist on primary source, in addition, the film about Manchurian memories has in mind an audience larger than the readers of academic writing and aims at transcending linguistic and national boundaries. The main idea that inspired the making of the film is the intensity that these memories have manifested and continue to do so beyond generations in various parts of the world. Filming has already taken place in China in 2009 and 2014, in Poland in 2013, and in Japan in 2014. More filming is planned in China, specifically aiming at interviewing Japanese war orphans who did not or could not return to Japan, as well as the Korean and Manzhou ethnic minorities. We also plan to conduct interviews in Russia, where several Harbin associations are very active, and in Israel, at Igud Yotzei Sin, the Association of the Jews of China, located in Tel Aviv. Additional sources are publications, visual materials, such as photographs and archival film footage. So concerning the Japanese memories, our main sources are interviews conducted in summer 2013 in Sapporo, Tokyo, and Iida City in Nagano Prefecture, of former rural settlers and other Japanese inhabitants of Manchuria or their descendants, including Japanese war orphans left behind in China and later repatriated to Japan. During a visit to Szczecin, Poland, in June 2012, we interviewed a number of former Polish residents of Harbin repatriated to Poland in the late 40s, early 50s, and relocated in the city. The word is used with quotation marks, since for most of them, this was the first journey to their homeland. The members of the Szczecin Klub Harbinczyka, Club of the Harbiner, meet several times a year, during which they exchange news and memories and sing their own Polish Harbin song. The encounter was intense and lasted for hours. While filming, I almost fainted because they didn't stop. We heard a flurry of stories about Polish life in Harbin and other places on the Zone of Alienation, Polasa Atchuzhdenia, of the Chinese Eastern Railway, CER. The school years in the Henryk Sienkiewicz Lyceum, the feasts in Gospoda Polska, the Polish club, etc. Numerous documents, photos, and memorabilia were displayed on a large table with the backdrop of a huge Russian map of Manchuria that had survived the transport to Poland. When we asked our hosts about their interaction in Manchuria with people from other nationalities, such as Russians, Chinese, Japanese, a genuine friendship of the peoples was invoked. Quote, "What made life special there," said one of the participants, "was a sort of ecumenism." Other interviews conducted in Warsaw 6 months before confirmed the overall nostalgic and positive vision of Polish life in Manchuria. Only one of the interviews diverged. That of a man whose father was Chinese and the mother Polish. His identity, he said, was always perceived as not right. In Polish, nie tak. He also added that many of Harbin's Russians had never set foot in what they called, most strangely, the Chinese part of the city. Russian memoirs published in the West tell a story very much reminding the Szczecin encounter. Starting to proliferate during the 1980s, memoirs and anthologies, mostly referring to the city of Harbin, depict an idyllic image of the life of the former Russian inhabitants in the Paris of the East during the first half of the 20th century. Elizaveta Raczynska's memoirs, Perelyotne Ptitsy, Migratory Birds, quote, dedicated to Harbin and the Harbiners, was one of the first. Many others followed, such as Viktor Petrov's Gorod na Sungari, the city on the Sungari. At the time of the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Harbin and Manchuria texts began to snowball in Russia, starting with Georgi Melikhov, Manchuria Dalyoka I Bliskaya, Manchuria Far Away and Close By, which appeared in 1991. Elena Taskina, Neizvestny Harbin, Unknown Harbin, published in 1994, and many other. Melikhov paints an idyllic picture of this collaboration, starting, quote, stating, quote, the main charm of this Russian city on Chinese land consisted primarily in the important cultural and enlightening role played by Harbin in the mutual enrichment and influence of two great cultures, the Russian and the Chinese, end quote. According to the author, quote, the whole history of the Chinese Eastern Railway was, in general, a beautiful illustration of this very simple fact that it was built and functioned in the interests of the two neighboring nations, the Russian and the Chinese, end quote. Well, since then, many other memoirs, anthologies, films about Harbin and Manchuria have appeared in Russia and elsewhere. One of them, the recent television serial in 8 parts, «Все началось в Харбине», «Everything Started in Harbin», produced by the Moscow-located studio Kobura Film, innovates. Romance and drama has replaced the idyll. Boris, the son of an employee of the Chinese Eastern Railway, sees his good life in Harbin coming to an end after his father is fired. We are in 1928, a time when the CER is administered by both Chinese and the Soviet. Unrequited love with Lyudmila, the daughter of the head of the CER, adds to his misery. When the Japanese occupy Harbin in 1932, Boris leaves Manchuria for the Soviet Union, where he's soon arrested and sent to the Gulag like other Biela Banditi, the white bandits from Harbin. One day he sees among his fellow inmates the former head of the CER. He learns that Lyudmila, too, was arrested and has been sent to a special settlement, etc., etc., etc. It's a happy end at the end. Okay. The Poles of Manchuria appeared soon on the memory market with Marek Sabanowski's 1993 Tajemnice Manchurii, Polacy w Harbinie, The Secrets of Manchuria, the Poles in Harbin, and Edward Kajdański's 2013 Wspomnienia z mojej Atlantydy, Memoirs of My Atlantis. A documentary film, Perła Północnych Chin, Epizod Polski, The Pearl of Northern China, a Polish episode, produced by Polish television in 1990, preceded Sabanowski's book. The Poles living in Harbin, in the zone of alienation of the Chinese Eastern Railway and other places in northeast China during the first half of the 20th century, experienced their status in a fundamentally different way than Russians. Most of them came to China as formal subjects of the Russian Empire, so therefore, the Poles of Harbin are part of Russia abroad. They were Russian citizens, but being Polish. Many of them left as citizens of the Republic of Poland, resurrected in 1918 as one of the consequences of World War I. But they shared in their minds and attitudes with the dual status as colonizer of China and as colonized by the Russian Empire, Prussia, and Habsburg Austria-Hungary after Poland's partitions. In Yellow Russia, that is Manchuria, the Poles were inhabitants of what the leader and ideologue of the Polish nationalist movement, Roman Dmowski, called, quote, the farthest borderlands, the conquest of which would create the one modern national idea. An important source for studying the history of the Poles in Manchuria is Kazimierz Grochowski's Polacy na Dalekim Wschodzie, The Poles in the Far East, a book published in Harbin in 1928. Grochowski was a Polish mining engineer, ethnographer, archaeologist, explorer, who after various expeditions in the Russian Far East, ended up in Manchuria. He taught at the Henry Sienkiewicz Lyceum, was one of the creators of the Manchuria Research Society, and founder of the Harbin journal Tygodnik Polski, Polish weekly. Grochowski lived long enough to witness the entry of the Japanese in Harbin and the creation of Manchukuo. 1 year after his death in 1937, Poland officially recognized the puppet state. Grochowski considered the Poles of Siberia and the Far East as, quote, the only living element of Western culture in that part of the world. underlining the essential contribution of Polish engineers in the construction of CER and Harbin, Grochowski framed the early history of Polish immigration to Manchuria in terms reminiscent of the history of early Christianity, that of persecution and slow proselytizing in an inhospitable and hostile environment. The Russians were among the persecutors, of course. They had forced all officers of the railway battalions in 1913 to adopt the Orthodox faith or get fired. Grochowski predicted that, quote, the omnipotence of God, end quote, would, quote, reduce to dust the former persecutors. History proved him right. The Tsarist regime was swept away in 1917. As to his attitude toward the Chinese, it was in tune with the other colonizers in Asia. The Poles, he wrote, should learn from the example of the Portuguese in Macau and other colonies. Quote, despite the fact that they kept their Portuguese language and a quite important percentage of the purity of their race, they have adopted such negative traits that the English, the Germans, the Scandinavians, and the French do not take them for Europeans anymore. A marriage with a Portuguese woman is considered the same mésalliance than if one marries a Chinese or a Mongolian woman. Therefore, Poles who are born and educated in the Far East should go to study in Poland for at least 3 to 5 years, so that during the period of their intellectual maturation, they can draw from the pure sources of Polishness. Konstanty Szymonolewicz was one of the higher officials of the Polish consulate in Harbin during the 20s and 30s. Here's what he wrote in his memoirs, which appeared in 1938. Quote, I saw foreign women who sincerely loved their Chinese husbands and usually found in them some hidden qualities. As to the reverse, to enjoy a Chinese woman is a matter of special taste. Polar opposites remain polar opposites, and there is nothing one can do about it, end quote. So to what extent the Poles of Harbin shared the opinions of Grochowski and Szymonolewicz is hard to assess. In any case, ecumenism had its limits. Let's come to the Jewish population of Harbin, which is a very fascinating thing, and a lot of scholars are actually working on that topic. Nationality Jewish. My only identity, it's a quote, my only identity was that of a Jew. And this is what I put on my high school diploma, nationality Jewish, in spite of fact that I was a Polish citizen. This is written by a former resident of Harbin who eventually immigrated to the United States. The fact that the Jews who lived in Manchuria and other parts of China were cosmopolitan intermediaries is perhaps what made them ideal citizens compared to other diasporas. Here are some more lines written by the just quoted former resident. The first 6-7 years of my life were spent almost entirely in the Jewish community. We lived among Jewish families, I went to a Jewish school, spent my leisure time involved with the Jewish youth organization Betar, and frequented mostly Jewish stores. The second 6 years were spent in cosmopolitan Harbin, in a British high school, a Russian music academy, a Japanese-run symphony orchestra, composed mostly of Russian emigre musicians, and at the YMCA college with its international faculty. In all these organizations, Jews were in a minority, often a sizable minority. Most of my close friends were still Jewish, but I also had Russian, Polish, Tatar, and Chinese friends, and on occasion dated non-Jewish girls, end quote. So Manchuria, in effect, was a privileged place, far from the pale of settlement, where Jews of the Russian Empire had to reside, and even further from Nazi Germany, from where any Jew had to escape if possible. For good reasons, Jews, by definition, did not participate in any of the national settings that created conflicts and believed in polar opposites, except when they had to defend themselves against the Russian fascists of Harbin. China and Harbin in particular was a suitable place to imagine Israel, which explains the remarkable persistence of Jewish former inhabitants of China from all over the world of remembering that country. More than other immigrants, the Jews of Harbin had something in common with the Chinese, as strange as this sounds. The Chinese also had come to Manchuria from elsewhere, Shandong, Hebei, and other regions south of the Great Wall, after the Qing Imperial Court relaxed the ban on Chinese immigration to Manchuria. Both Jews and Chinese were migrants and sojourners, but numbers matter, of course. About 500,000 of Chinese migrated to the three eastern provinces every year between 1890 and 1942, about 8 million altogether. Prasenjit Duwara writes about the, quote, irony of the Chinese demographic and administrative domination of the region by the early 20th century. It was taking place at the same time that, and to some extent because, outside claims on the region were being made by the imperialist powers of Russia and Japan, who financed and ran the first railroads. This irony is what most Western memory writing tends to forget. It is what Louise Young rightly calls the broader context of global crisis. The idealistic and somehow paternalistic vision, to say the least, of most Russian memoirs forgets about the colonial advances of Russia in the region during the second half of the 19th and early 20th century. This includes the gain by Russia of large portions of Manchuria, including today's Primorye, maritime province, after the Aigun Treaty of 1858 and the Treaty of Peking of 1860, the control over the Amur River for navigation, and the seaports of Dairen and Port Arthur in the Liaodong Peninsula. The military control over the entire region as a consequence of the Boxer Uprising of 1900, and last but not least, the right obtained by Russia from the Qing Imperial Government to construct and maintain control over the Chinese Eastern Railway and its right-of-way territories, including its hub, rapidly becoming the burgeoning city of Harbin. Russia's influence started to dwindle after the other major competitor of the region, Japan, achieved its surprising victory in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905 and was granted the Russian lease on the Liaodong Peninsula and the South Manchurian Railroad in the Treaty of Portsmouth, while China regained, in theory, its sovereignty in Manchuria. Japan increased its interest and influence since then. So some aspects of the idyllic dimension underlying the memoirs of Melikhov, Taskina, Tsabanovsky, and many others are explained by historiography, academic historiography. I have in mind David Wolf's book, To the Harbin Station, The Liberal Alternative in Russian Manchuria, 1898-1914. One of the insights we gain from this work is that after the Russo-Japanese War, Russia, humbled by its defeat, would learn important lessons. That was a quote. According to Wolf, among the measures adopted were more cooperative methods of governance carried out in Harbin. These enlightened local ethnic and political policies contradict our usual vision of late imperial Russia. They were in line with the semi-parliamentary reforms of 1905. In addition, sinology, which was at a high level in Harbin, helped to bridge between cultures. Wolf writes, quote, what the Russians had learned in defeat was lost on the victorious Japanese, just beginning their imperialistic path to disaster in 1945. Only by recovering the triangular relations with China can we understand why the 20th century will be remembered as a century of bilateral Russo-Japanese enmity, while the mainly good relations of the 19th century have been forgotten. Largely forgotten. Harbin stands squarely at the turning point of these centuries, of these diverging memories, just like a turn in the road where a traveler can look both forward and back. An analysis of Harbin's early years allows the historian to explain much about the fateful course of Northeast Asian history, both the road taken and the options left untrodden. Considering the road taken, I will pass on the events leading to the Manchurian incident of 18 September 32, the occupation of Manchuria by the Kwantung Army, the creation of Manchukuo, its phase of relative independence followed by the ever-increased presence of Japan in Manchuria, with the advent of the Pacific War, and other fateful historical events, which came to a conclusion with Japan's capitulation in 1945, the Soviet invasion, the end of the Great Manchurian Empire, followed by the tragedy of the Japanese exodus. Some of this history has reached the great public, with, for example, Bertolucci's 87 dramatization of the life of Puyi in The Last Emperor. And in the case of Japan, the flood of memories about the Manchurian tragedy that have not abated since the post-war year. And this type of Japanese publications are very rarely known in the West. I think it's worth looking at them. So despite what we know about the brutality of the Manchukuo regime, Unit 731, which was a Japanese unit experimenting on humans, doing terrible things with them, something like that was done, also in Auschwitz, very similar to these kind of things. So Unit 731 and other dark sides of the Japanese involvement in Manchuria, the theme of idyll resurfaces. 22 years after the end of the war, Furumi Tatayuki, a former resident of Manchuria, remembers, quote, we young Japanese at the time were burning with passion to establish an ideal state on Manchurian terrain in which there would be ethnic harmony, and thus we hurried off to Manchukuo. We poured our hearts and souls into building such a state. As history moved forward, the ideal of ethnic harmony would have gradually increased in radiance. Without this, I believe that perpetual peace in the world is impossible to attain. In this sense, the ideals of building the state of Manchukuo will live on forever, end quote. So, easy, unrepentant witness, delusion. I think the two sides, two faces, appear in the historical interpretations of the puppet state, which remind us of the divergent, or better, conflicting memories that we have observed before. Not unlike the Poles of Harbin or their Russian neighbors, who at some point of their existence in Manchuria had to make the choice between Soviet citizenship and statelessness, both turned out to be rather bad choices. The Japanese were colonizers, no doubt, but many of them were ultimately objects and victims of the empire's colonization policy. I have in mind the hundreds of thousands of impoverished agricultural settlers from Nagano, Yamagata, and elsewhere who answered the call of 1 million families to Manchuria, of the Patriotic Youth Brigade and other such programs. Of the 223,000 settlers who resided in Manchuria, only 140,000 returned to Japan. More than 11,000 died violently. About 67,000 died of starvation and disease during the aftermath of the Soviet invasion. The countless stories of the living hell that they endured during the last months of their exodus, those who survived blame the Chinese, the Russians, as well as the Kwantung Army, who abandoned them. They were victims of empire, concludes Louise Young in her book, Japan's Total Empire. At the same time, she adds, quote, "They did buy and savor, if only for a short time, their piece of empire. In this sense, they were not so different from most other Japanese who both benefited and suffered from the imperial paradise in Manchuria." And I think we can say, to some extent, the same thing for the Russians who lived in Harbin and elsewhere, for the Poles and many other foreigners. They had their piece of empire. They had their piece of colony, even if they were colonizers. The Poles, for instance. The interviews conducted with Shinzo Araragi in Ida City in July 2014 seem to confirm Young's assessment. As far as I can judge I don't speak Japanese, so all this had to be translated. It was quite complicated. But what I can judge from the first batch of translations received to date, the memories of former Japanese settlers are, even today, 69 years after the end of the war, sharply divided. But they also strangely converge. Two of our correspondents, Kubota-san and Yuzawa-san, went to Manchuria at the age of 14 to join the Youth Volunteer Corps in 1944. Kubota was one of the two survivors of a collective suicide. Repeatedly assaulted and stripped naked by mobs of Manchurians, meaning Chinese, about 70 members of the Kawanaka branch village decided to die rather than suffering further abuse. They, quote, strangled children with women obi belts and picked up stones and beat each other to death in the middle of the forehead, end quote. Kubota and other of his comrades survived and were repatriated to Japan a few years later. For Kubota, the word Manchuria is synonym of fear and terror. He never went back. Yuzawa, the other man, did not have to survive collective suicide, but suffered extreme hardship nonetheless. Here's a description related to the death of his friend, another member of the Youth Volunteer Corps. Quote, "The Songhua River, or the Songari River in Russian, the Songhua River, which was 1 kilometer wide, was all frozen. Even a big tank could go over. The body was enshrined in the middle of the Songhua River. On the next day, it was stripped of all it had and was naked. That was how poor the local people were. As time passed, spring came, ice melted, and the body went from the Songhua River to the Amur, then to the Sea of Ochotsk, and then to the Sea of Japan. Water is all connected on Earth, so probably the body became fog and clouds, and reached hills and fields in his homeland before we went back," end quote. Yuzawa kept on returning many times to Manchuria and keeps close ties with his Chinese foster family and his Chinese friends. Asked what the word Manchuria means for him, he answered, quote, "As a matter of fact, the word Manchuria is already a dead word, which I think is really sad. I want society to use the word more. Am I too obsessed with Manchuria?" Asked the same question, Kubota found no words. When he first returned to Japan, he kept silent about his Manchurian past. Quote, "We were kept at a distance. We were abandoned people. We were repatriates." Today, however, he does not refuse to talk. Yuzawa also likes to share his memories on the radio, high schools, and spirit-consoling gatherings. In Manchuria under Japanese dominion, Shinichi Yamamuro also offers two polar images of Manchuria. On the one hand, the image of a chimera, a monster. On the other, a mixture of dreams and lofty ideals. According to Yamamuro, it is undeniable that many people went to Manchuria out of sympathy for these ideals. How earnest was their belief and how fake was the puppet state? Prasajit Dura questions the very designation of puppet state as fundamentally colonial, arguing that the creation of Manchukuo quote, foreshadowed the imperialism of the post-war period, especially of the Cold War, when, despite of independence declared by many countries, the new imperial powers retained considerable economic and military control over their client states, their client nation states, end quote. Yamamoto advances a similar argument, quote again, in the post-war period, even now, many people continue to believe that one cannot explain the Japanese-Manchukuo relationship on the basis of a Western political science concept by invoking the concept of a puppet state. While qualifying this belief as intellectual arrogance, Yamamoto observes that there is a flip side to it. Quote, for Western political science and jurisprudence themselves, the concept of civilization is what comprised the grounding for Japanese encroachments upon Asia and legitimizing control over Manchukuo. Beside the enthusiasm for the ideals of the paradise of the kingly way, there were other more practical reasons to move to Manchuria. Yamamoto calls it modern Japan's only asylum. For many Japanese, the great and wild expanses of Manchuria and Mongolia were a space to escape from cramped and overpopulated Japan. In addition, many leftists found a refuge in the bureaucracy of the South Manchurian Railway in Manchukuo. And by the way, if you look at these Manchukuo films that have been surviving thanks to the Red Army that captured all these films and kept them in the Moscow archives, they're extraordinarily close to, you know, avant-garde filmmaking. The Japanese were fascinated by the Russian avant-garde filmmaking. So it's a really interesting thing to look at. So the new capital of Manchukuo, Xinjing, Changchun in Chinese, with its new buildings, parks, including the new sewer system, all this made Manchukuo's capital more modern than Tokyo. The Pearl of the North, Dairen, formerly Russian Dalny, Dalian today, was famous for its South Manchurian Railway Hospital, the model for all East Asia. Harbin was another exotic place to visit. Here are some lines by the writer Tachibana Soto, entitled The Melancholy of Harbin. It's one of my favorite quotes, actually. Harbin, it is Shanghai without the sea. Here the bizarre, the romantic, and the adventurous come flowing together in a whirlpool, an international city in North Manchuria, in which past and future play a zigzag symphony. Great princes and dukes of the Russian Tsar reduce the poverty, polish the shoes of passersby on the street corners, and leading dancers from the Imperial Opera Company have grown old and sell matches on the roadside. What a terribly sad city. The experience of the Japanese rural settlers was, of course, very different, depending on the various forms of rural settlement. Colonization by armed groups of immigrants in the North and East Manchuria started in 1932 with a volunteer army of young colonists known as the Frontier Guardians of the Showa era. They paid the greatest price during the Soviet invasion. If there was a tacit alliance between the Manchukuo state and local elites, redemptive societies and the Chinese landed classes, fearing communism and destabilization, the Chinese peasants of Manchuria reacted to Japanese colonization with frustration, resistance, and vengeance after the collapse of Manchukuo. More than a quarter of Chinese and Korean farmers lost their land through price manipulations, coerced sales, and forced evictions. The Chinese inhabitants of Manchukuo, representing the majority of the population, were called Manchurians, Manjin, and could not call themselves otherwise. Chinese people, Chukokujin, were potential bandits and insurgents. Discriminations against Manjin were at the order of the day. At banquets, the Japanese would be served white rice. Manchurians would get sorghum. To quote Shinichi Yamamoto again, quote, even with the disappearance of states and the passage of peoples, the past lives on a solemn fact. Manchukuo, which brought together people's dreams and hopes, crimes and rage, tragedies and privations, and sucked their blood and sweat and tears, disappeared. However, while taking its condensed history as food for thought, the great land of China's northeast is vast and limitless, sustaining people even today and spreading out to eternity. End quote. So one of the solemn facts that we were able to film in 2009 was the grave of a husband and wife. Behind a garland of flowers swinging in the wind, two photographs were affixed on the tombstone, that of a Chinese man and a Russian woman. It made me think that Simonolevich might have been right, so we looked for other mixed graves and only saw one or two. The husbands were always Chinese. Their wives must have found them in them some hidden qualities. There was, however, a problem with this grave and with the whole cemetery. The latter had been relocated from the center of the city to Huangshan in the eastern suburb of Harbin. According to the official version, between 1958 and 1962, small portions of the Russian Orthodox cemetery and of the Jewish cemetery were transported to Huangshan. As far as the Russian cemetery goes, out of 135,000, only 60 graves were allocated. In comparison, the Jewish dead fared much better. Out of 3,000 graves, 800 took the road to their new home. However, new evidence suggests that all these graves, Russian, Orthodox, or Jewish, are empty. There were no traces of bones or coffins in the recent diggings of Hongshan Cemetery. So while these findings might be very upsetting for an archaeologist, they shouldn't frustrate the historian. Emptiness is part of history. Some 16 years ago, a heated discussion among Chinese historians, journalists, party and governmental officials confirmed this truth. They debated whether the 100th birthday of Harbin should be celebrated or not in 1998. The final decision was not to worry about the date, not to celebrate the centennial, but, quote, to put on stage history in order to perform the play of economy. I love that quote. So once again, to put on stage history in order to perform the play of economy. Since then, Harbin has been performing this play with great success. Former Kitaiskaya Chinese Street, now called the Zhongyang Dajie, Central Street, in the former Russian and most international district of Daoli, literally within the railway tracks, has become Russian again, with Russian restaurants, matryoshki, and other folkloric souvenirs, made in China, of course, and loudspeakers softly playing Russian melodies such as Pasmakovne Vechera and Katyusha. St. Nicholas Cathedral, destroyed by Red Guards in 1966, and the poster that I saw yesterday that announces the conference and this event shows this beautiful cathedral. Well, this cathedral was destroyed in 1966. Well, it has been rebuilt. But also, it has also experienced relocation. A real-size copy of the destroyed original has been constructed entirely without a single nail, in Volga Manor, a Russian theme park on the Ashi River, rebaptized Volga River, not far from Harbin. It was designed and financed by a Shanghai businessman, quote, in love with Russian things. Inside the cathedral, the visitor can admire the copy of an entire iconostasis and listen to recordings of Orthodox religious singing. There's also a Russian castle, previously a Russian hospital, police station. And there is a nightclub where real Russian performers entertain the visitors, a restaurant in form of a ship, the original burned down in Harbin, and a former textile factory that is now the central tourist store. So the former Chinese part of Harbin, Dawai, on the outside of the tracks, or Fujiajian, is presently being restored, which is another form of relocation. In summer 2014, many buildings that we filmed in 2009 had already gone. Original facades in Chinese Baroque adorned the new constructions in concrete, hosting businesses and fashion shops. As to the original inhabitants, they too have been relocated. In an article of 2008, the German historian Sören Urbanski gives a damning assessment of the eradication and polishing up of Harbin's architectural heritage. Quote, since the 1990s, the historical center of the city of Harbin is experiencing a revival after decades of decline, but the preservation of the architectural ensemble serves above all the interest of the tourist industry. What dominates is imitation and kitsch, end quote. So Urbanski provides details of this preservation process, including the creation of a register of buildings worth preserving in 1996-97 by Chinese experts on behalf of the city council. Consulted was the Khabarovsk architect and architectural historian Nikolai Kradin, stating that the register did not protect the buildings from neglect, destruction, the overall pressures of the real estate market. Urbanski gives specific examples of how historical buildings and streets have been transformed into objects of the tourism industry. So there is no doubt that Harbin has taken the path of the theme parkization that is sweeping through China, including the Northeast. In Dalian, for example, there is a Russian quarter, as well as a Japanese street. And its central Zhongshan Square, the Japanese-built Yamamoto Hotel, then owned by the South Manchurian Railway, is still there, and so is the City Hall, now hosting the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. There is the former police station, now Citibank's Dalian branch, and other historical buildings. At night, they turn into a fairy of green, purple, and yellow. Harbin, too, has turned yellow, but it's Viennese or Maria Theresa yellow, a color that one can see on many of the historic buildings of St. Petersburg and other Russian cities. In Harbin, however, every second building, old and new, is painted in this color. During a recent visit, I asked Harbin's deputy mayor, Mrs. Chulé, about the rationale of this massive operation. She answered that this color, quote, makes people feel comfortable because of the long and harsh winter. I was not convinced. Viennese yellow, Maria Theresa yellow, is rather pale and very cold, actually. She added the choice of color was in tune with Harbin's unique foreign past, that it was Harbin that introduced Western culture into China, and that there is a general plan to restore all historical buildings of Harbin's inner city, give them a new life, a new function, quote, so that the residents and tourists can use them, enjoy them, and discover the history behind these buildings. I did not ask her about another striking phenomenon as massive as the use of yellow, the multiplication of Russian architectural details. The onion dome of restored St. Sophia Church, now a museum, until the 1980s it served as a warehouse, is repeated on top of a contemporary Chinese high-rise, followed by the conical-shaped pinnacle of another high-rise. The parapet roofs of other buildings echo the balustrades of old Russian mansions, and so do the arched windows on the top floors of a skyscraper. It's just all over the place. It's quite incredible. It's just Russian cities, the Russian city on top of the skyscrapers. Conclusion. I would call the conclusion performing history. So let me risk, maybe it's a far-fetched interpretation, but I believe in it. All this might be more than putting on stage history in order to perform the play of economy. It might have something to do with what Rana Mitter called the Manchurian myth, that is, the narrative of the popular resistance movement after the occupation of Manchuria by the Kwantung Army and the creation of Manchukuo. Quote, a new language of resistance that has not been erased from the collective Chinese memory even today. End quote. Well, in the context of today's socialism with Chinese characteristics, it could be called local patriotism. To remember so massively Harbin's foreignness in the solemn facts of architecture and city planning is perhaps a vestige of Manchuria's special status in Chinese history, a distant memory of the homeland that the Qing emperors kept and lost as a preserve of their own. So is the revival, reinvention, and promotion since the 1980s of the Manzhu ethnicity, described by Shaodan in her book, Remote Homeland, Recovered Borderland. Quote, the present generation of young Manzhu in their 20s and 30s grew up with popularized or entertainmentized knowledge about the Qing Empire and the local history of Manchuria gained through literature and media, such as the press, television, drama series, exhibitions for tourists, musicals, and films in the 1980s and 1990s, end quote. In Japan, too, memory has performed the play of economy. In the 1980s already, former settlers of Manchuria were invited by the tourist industry to relive their past by participating in repatriation reenactments. Mariko Tamanoi gives the example of a reenactment trip to the port of Sasebo, in which more than 1,000 former settlers participated. What was at work, according to her, was imperialist nostalgia. As to the memory industry, she writes, quote, it has been playing the major role in assisting the Japanese people to forget the power of their own state, which once dominated ordinary Chinese people in the place where they now entertain themselves, end quote. So what does Manchuria, a phantasmal empire that lasted only 13 years, mean to contemporary intellectuals? Why do contemporary writers and artists return to it again and again? These are questions that Fei Yuan Kliman asked in an article tracing the evolution of Japanese imperial fantasies in travelogues, poems, novels, up to contemporary TV serials, films, manga, and other fictional reimaginations of Manchuria. Kliman perceives in the letter, quote, a new way to inscribe a Japanese vision upon a post-colonial East Asia. They seek to reopen the epistemic fracture of imperialism without succumbing to nostalgia for the lost utopia of a fallen empire, end quote. So during our interview in summer 2014 of members of the International Association of Good Neighborliness, Kokusai Zenrin Kyokai, a Tokyo-based association gathering many former Japanese residents of Manchuria, we were given a catalog of the work of photo artist Kasagi Etsuko, entitled Strange Mother, Photography with Two Times. By way of computer-assisted photomontage, Kasagi inserts her own photographs into pictures showing her mother and the other way around. The places where Kasagi's mother spent the first 22 years of her life before her repatriation to Japan in 1946 pervade most compositions. They are all Japan's de facto colonies, Korea, where the mother was born in 1924, Taiwan, and Manchuria. The cover page of the catalog shows a black and white photograph in which appears her mother together with what seems to be her parents. She's sitting in front of them, and so is facing her daughter Etsuko, by means of a superimposed color photograph. The photos of both women were taken when they were approximately the same age. The work is entitled, With Mother Wearing a Dress with Breast Pockets at the Age of 17 in an Apple Field, Harbin, Manchuria, in 1941. What epistemic fracture this work opens is not clear to me, but Manchuria and other places of Japan's colonial past are undoubtedly present in this specific memory map. For us, Kasagi Atsuko's photomontage felt strangely familiar. After all, film, too, superimposes times, places, and peoples. However, what we are attempting in constructing the film that you're going to see is to put on stage the play of economy to perform history. Thank you very much.